The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. This week, it's part two of our look at what the research shows about Oregon's Measure 110, the Drug Addiction Treatment and Recovery Act. RTI International hosted a research symposium on Measure 110 on January 22nd. There were a number of great speakers, some excellent presentations. Let's hear Kristen Donhefner, MPH, M110 Engagement and Strategy Manager in the Health Systems Division at the Oregon Health Authority. Her presentation is entitled Measure 110, 1 Year of Implementation.
So I know many of you are familiar with Measure 110, but I always like to level set what the Oregon Health Authority's role in the program is. Passed by Oregon voters in 2020, OHA's role was really to help transform the state's approach to addiction treatment services and through the service delivery model. OHA really doesn't have anything to do with decriminalization. But the major thing that the law did do was redirect a significant portion of cannabis tax revenue to establish county-based behavioral health resource networks, or BERNs, to provide treatment and recovery services and supports. These networks were fully up and running by summer 2022, resulting in 42 networks across Oregon's 36 counties. 226 separate grants with separate treatment providers, and 11 tribal grant agreements with our tribal partners through a dedicated set-aside. Each BERN is statutorily required to provide 7 services, and those are screening and assessments, peer services, harm reduction interventions, low-barrier substance use treatments, housing and employment supports. And importantly, I always like to point out that many of these services are not covered by Medicaid or by insurance. Of all of these, some screenings are, some treatment is, some peer services is, but housing, employment supports, harm reduction interventions, a lot of peer services are not covered by insurance. So Measure 110 is really, we call it the water that trickles down and fills in the gaps in the continuum of care that previously have not had any dedicated source of funding. Measure 110 also created the Oversight and Accountability Council. You heard from Morgan. Morgan is a member. And this is a panel of community members with lived experience with substance use treatment, and importantly, they drive the grant funding decision-making and the program decision-making, which really turned a power dynamic on its head, placing OHA in really a support role and the council in the driver's seat on this program. I would also be remiss if I don't talk about some of the changes that were made during the last legislative session. As we head into a new legislative session next month, House Bill 2513, led by Rep. Rob Noss, Portland, and a legislative work group made up of several people who I know are in this room as well, really worked to streamline some of the operations of Measure 110, clarify some of the roles and responsibilities, and enhance coordination between BERNs and other community mental health and substance use treatment providers. And it did this through a number of things listed on the slide, but in the goal of saving a little bit of time, I just want to flag that it happened, and we are implementing it as of this month. Oh, yeah. But really what I want to talk about is kind of a full year of implementation data that we've now published as of a few weeks ago. Looking at the timeline of Measure 110, passed in November 2020, codified in June 2021 by Senate Bill 755, and really not funded until around May 2022, we haven't started receiving data from BERN providers until January 2023. So we have We receive quarterly sets of data from our providers from the previous quarter. So we have data dumps from January 23, April 23, July 23, and October 23. So a full year of data. But importantly, you'll see that the funding beginning and that data being collected in July really wasn't a whole lot of time to see those early results. So we're just now starting to really see the promise of Measure 110 coming into fruition. So this is a screenshot of our data dashboard, which is posted on our website and made by, I can't claim any credit for this, it's all made by our fabulous health policy and analytics data team. But the data dashboard displays all of the BIRM partners by counties and services provided. If you're looking for a city or a county and what kinds of services they have, it's all searchable. The dashboard also displays aggregated number of clients, client encounters, and expenditures by county and by service, some basic demographic data, and some narrative information on the successes, challenges, and outreach efforts that our partners do every day. And from this, you can see there is a steady, slow but steady increase in the trend line of client encounters statewide. From the very first quarter, July through September of 2022, through that same period of 23, you see slowly we're making progress at seeing more people across the state. And there are two categories that I really want to call out here, and that is peer services and harm reduction. And these two represent the highest number of client encounters statewide. And I think it's really important to note that these are two services that are not covered by insurance. We see a lot of people accessing treatment services, but Measure 110 by statute is a payer of last resort. And so that's not going to capture anyone who has Medicaid, anyone who has private insurance, and anyone whose cost of treatment is being billed to their insurer. There are a lot of uninsured people in Oregon still, but I think it's really important to note that that number looks smaller because it doesn't include a lot of people who have insurance and are receiving treatment services, historically traditional treatment services, that way. But what we see here is a lot of people accessing peer support and harm reduction, which I think shows a need and a demand in the community that Measure 110 is finally able to meet for really the first time. This is also a screenshot of expenditure data. And you can also see the trend line continuing to go up quarter over quarter. BIRM providers are slowly actually spending this money over time. And there is a lag in that spending money, which I know was just referenced in one of the comments. And we know that's because there are lags in hiring. There needs to be time for these programs to get stood up. I think I'll point to a couple things that stand out to me from this slide. Again, we see peer support services, a lot of spending in that category. And that's those peers are doing street outreach. They're providing food, they're providing water, they're providing basic necessities, information. They're providing bus passes, rides to treatment. They're really filling in any gap that people might be experiencing to get them into treatment. We also see not a lot of spending in harm reduction. But if you remember the previous slide, we saw a lot of client encounters and harm reduction. What that tells me is it's a pretty low cost intervention that's still able to reach a lot of people. Finally, you'll see quite a big jump in housing services. Measure 110 funding is different. It's cannabis tax dollars. It's not federal funding. It's not general fund funding. And so Measure 110 can purchase infrastructure. We can buy buildings, we can buy houses, we can buy apartments and motels and places for people to live. And so this big spike, which we're just now kind of starting to see dip down, represents a lot of initial investments in infrastructure. And if you buy a 15-room motel now, yeah, it's going to cost a lot of money. But over time, how many people is that hotel going to serve? A lot of people, because we bought it. It's going to be there for the next 20 years. Serving people in their community. So it's an investment that will pay off in the future and an investment that no one else really no other pots of money are regularly, consistently making in this service. And as we go through time, we're expecting to see more of that shift away from capital purchases and towards just the consistent delivery of care. So a year in, what we do know is that we're seeing steady increases in the number of clients and client encounters that Measure 110 reaches. Over 100% increase in people seeking treatment services and harm reduction services. And over a 200%, almost 300% increase in clients seeking initial help or housing services. And it's important to note, we don't have great baseline data because, again, nobody was funding this before Measure 110 came along. So we're really comparing this to our first quarter numbers, which is a limitation to our data that I'll talk about in a little bit. By statute, some of the future data that we are hoping to provide and building some of the internal structures and working with our providers to understand is better real D demographic information. So we know if we're reaching communities most impacted by the war on drugs. Information to assess capacity and progress of specific service types, reasons for any denials of service, and client level data for certain services to be able to track individual outcomes for people served by multiple providers throughout the continuum of care. So I did mention that we have data challenges to the data collection. And I think we also got a preview of that in the previous comment. House Bill 2513 and Senate Bill 755 do have stipulate the kind of data collection that we are required to meet. And those requirements are difficult. There is a lag in data collection. The information that we collect is reported for the previous quarter and kind of goes through a screening and validation process on our end. And some of these challenges were also identified in a recent Secretary of State financial audit that was also statutorily required. So we're working to capture those challenges and offer some alternative approaches to the legislature when they convene next month. But one of our biggest identified challenges is really that Measure 110 client encounters don't really lend themselves to collect client level data due to stigma, the type of services provided, the places they're being provided, outreach, in a camp, at a street fair, at a farmer's market. Those kinds of encounters might help hook people and get new clients and get them interested and build trust, but you're not going to sit there with your clipboard and your pen and right away start recording client demographic information. I know I wouldn't want to give that up if I were a client in that situation. And we never want collection of client level data to be a barrier towards someone receiving care. The second big challenge is capturing these system-wide benefits that we know Measure 110 is providing. Even if we could capture more client level data, we wouldn't necessarily see that data show the benefits of the bigger picture thanks to Measure 110. Measure 110's increased the number of outreach events people have gone to. It's engaged with more people using substances. It's built things. It's built those infrastructures. It's purchased those motels. It's bought vans to transport clients to and from. It's built referral pathways. And we're not going to understand that through just looking at, oh, Measure 110 served 100 people this month and 200 people that month. It's not going to capture the system-wide benefits and improvements to our broader continuum of care and substance use system.
You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's get back to Kristen Donhefner, MPH, M110 Engagement and Strategy Manager in the Health Systems Division at the Oregon Health Authority, and her presentation entitled Measure 110, 1 Year of Implementation.
Pivoting a little bit away from data and to the actual services being provided. On this slide from our dashboard, you see the types of outreach that people, our Measure 110 funded providers are doing. They're providing peer support services, education, basic needs, harm reduction, food, transportation, safe supplies, and Class E violation help. They're performing this at community service locations, street locations, clinical settings, street fairs, jails and prisons, and K through 12 schools and universities. And the populations they're reaching out to include unhoused individuals, incarcerated people, or those who are about to be released, culturally and linguistically specific populations, parents or pregnant people, youth, law enforcement, and immigrants and refugee populations, just to name a few. And so again, these are locations where people are in their community. This isn't a model that expects people to figure out where to go. It's a system that goes to people, and importantly, goes to people who have traditionally been left behind by our traditional healthcare system. Every quarter, we ask our providers what their top successes and challenges are and how they've been able to use Measure 110 to lower barriers. So some of those top successes consistently have been strengthening partnerships, opening new programs, expanding services, seeing more clients, and engaging community via outreach and peers. Again, these are successes that might not necessarily be captured simply by saying Measure 110 served 100 people this month and 200 people in the next month. Providers have reported some of the barriers they've been able to lower have been not only expanding services, but providing virtual or mobile services. Again, meeting people where they are instead of having them come to where services are. Increasing the outreach and providing holistic care, including childcare and transportation. And some of the challenges that we've consistently heard, and I don't think will come as a surprise to anyone, is struggling to hire and retain staff. Oregon is facing a severe provider shortage in the behavioral health workforce space, in the substance use treatment space. And that means that we have providers who've said, hey, we want to do more, but we've had these FTEs open for a year now, and we can't find anyone to fill these positions. And that's resulted in a lot of challenges in just building programs and expanding programs, not being able to fully staff them. And then finally, there's just, I think, a woeful lack of treatment beds and culturally appropriate services. And again, those are staffed treatment beds. There might be a bed, but if there's no one there to staff it, it doesn't really count. But I wanted to wrap up with just a few vignettes of some of the successes that we've seen across the state. And this is from a subset of Lane County burn providers down in Eugene. This information comes to us through a University of Oregon research project who reported that over 8,000 residents received coordinated care from these burn partners. Over 1,000. Yeah, that sounds pretty good, right? That's not bad. Over 1,000 residents received LGBTQIA+ specific or youth specific services. Over 1,000 residents received peer services that otherwise weren't billable by Medicaid. Because again, if you remember one thing from this, it's that Measure 110 funds things that otherwise aren't funded. Over 5,000 residents received harm reduction and overdose prevention services, over 200 received supported employment services, and over 100 people received housing, including veteran-specific housing, low-barrier housing, and rental assistance. One provider in the Portland metro area was able to kind of look at the system impacts thanks to Measure 110, and they saw that their outpatient service census grew by 22% thanks to what they saw as increased access to peers, housing, and care coordination. They saw a 20% increase in assessments. That's people just wanting to start care. They saw over 100% increase in that co-occurring mental health, behavioral health services space. And while Measure 110 doesn't fund mental health services, that's a spillover effect that this provider is seeing from being able to expand what they're able to offer substance use patients. And they saw over 100% increase in that care coordination service. Again, making sure that people have a holistic approach to what they need. In Southern Oregon, two Measure 110 organizations joined together to open emergency lodging apartments for pregnant people who were unhoused or unsafely housed using substances and on a wait list for treatment beds. And since July, 11 women have lived there and moved on to receive residential treatment or detox. And then finally, in Eastern Oregon, I think this burn provider really captured some of the other services, again, that aren't funded by Medicaid, offering fresh food, a shower, and a space to rest, just basic human services for people. Their emergency housing vouchers have been a lifesaver for many individuals. In many cases, these clients agree to join their caseload, which means they can help with all of their needs. And they're on pace to meet their goal of serving over 100 clients each month. And that's in Umatilla County. So looking forward, in addition to just continuing this work, we're continuing to collect this data. We're continuing to support our burn providers and publish this data so that it is transparent, that it is out there, that we can share both the successes and the challenges and the frustrations with people like Representative Nose and Senator Patterson, who are good thought partners at working to address some of these intangible, intractable issues. We're also looking to the future. A next grant award cycle will already start beginning for funding awarding in July 2025. And with that will come new rules and a new grant application. So we're looking forward. We're looking to support the work that's being done, continue it, and sustain it in the future.
That was Kristen Dawn-Hefner, MPH, M110 Engagement and Strategy Manager at the Oregon Health Authority, speaking January 22nd at the 2024 Measure 110 Research Symposium sponsored by RTI International. Her presentation was entitled Measure 110, 1 Year of Implementation. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On January 11th and 12th, the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine's Committee on the Public Health Consequences of Changes in the Cannabis Policy Landscape hosted public information gathering sessions for the committee's third full meeting. One of the experts who spoke at that meeting was Sheila Vakaria, PhD, MSW, Deputy Director of the Department of Research and Academic Engagement at the Drug Policy Alliance, and author of The Harm Reduction Gap, Helping Individuals Left Behind by Conventional Drug Prevention and Abstinence-Only Addiction Treatment.
A foundational harm reduction tenet is that drugs and psychoactive mood-altering substances are here to stay, and that all societies have used mood-altering substances over the course of history. And in many ways, these societies and cultures have various rules and norms and mores around substance use that often promoted moderate or occasional use, or in certain circumstances, higher frequency or higher amounts of use during certain accepted times, oftentimes including substances in ritualistic, religious, or spiritual practices. And we can think of the use of various plant substances with psychoactive effects for a variety of uses in societies around the world. And harm reductionists fundamentally believe that drugs are not going away, and the aim of a drug-free world is unrealistic and unnecessary, and that even this concept of what a drug is, what qualifies as a drug, can often change based on social and cultural norms, changing policy contexts, and various other kind of shifts that happen over time. And so this idea that drug use is a criminal issue is not one that's ascribed to by harm reductionists. We do not believe that drug use is immoral. It reflects on anyone's morality, but we also don't believe that the psychoactive substances that someone consumes should be a criminal issue as well. And when harm reductionists do talk about drug use, they try to be as precise as possible when talking about the kinds of drug use and patterns that that people engage in. And it's through being able to talk about substances openly, freely, and without judgment that we can actually understand the nuances of people's drug use and how to help people stay safe, right? So first and foremost, harm reductionists talk about how drug use occurs on a continuum, right? And that it includes people who may engage in complete abstinence, to people who may engage in social, recreational, or experimental use, people who engage in more frequent levels of use, and people who experience harmful or negative consequences, and people who may have more severe problems with substances, right? But a key thing that harm reductionists remind people is that not all use is problematic or harmful, and Someone's status as being a person who uses substances doesn't necessarily tell us about whether that use is harmful or dangerous to them or a risk factor for other concerns. You have to ask more questions and understand more about the context and the situations in which someone uses a substance. But that also the fact that someone uses a substance doesn't necessarily mean that that use rises up to the level of causing harmful effects, right? And so using terms like saying that someone's engaging in so-called abuse or misuse without actually asking follow-up questions about the patterns of use, the consequences, those are presumptions that are often grounded in stigma rather than really understanding how it is that people engage with substances in their lives. It's also really important when harm reductionists talk about drug use more broadly that we have conversations with people about each of the specific drugs that they use, understanding that someone's problematic patterns with one drug may not translate into their relationships with other drugs. Some people can engage in low risk, non-problematic use of a variety of substances, but there may be one or two drugs that they engage in riskier practices around. And it's really important when we don't look at drugs as a monolith, but also when we don't just presume that someone saying that they use drugs means that they have a problem, we can then have these broader, deeper conversations to understand each substance that they use, the ways in which they use them, the things about their use that concerns them, and then how we can intervene to help them stay safe, right? It's also really important, and harm reductionists often talk about this, that harm is relative, right? So what qualifies as a drug-related harm in one person's life, for instance, waking up with a hangover and missing a class or missing a day of work, maybe for someone who doesn't really use substances, a pretty terrible, traumatic, horrible consequence that leads them to decide, I do not want to engage in substance use like this again. I will not be consuming alcohol on weeknights or the night before a class because I understand that this is a big problem for me. Whereas someone who is engaging in substance use and also maybe facing the same consequence may contextualize that harm within other harms that they are facing, but also like doing a cost-benefit analysis of what that harm is relative to the so-called gains or benefits or reasons that they were using that substance, right? So again, it's really important as harm reductionists not to assume that we understand how a harm is experienced by a person and to understand that harms are experienced and interpreted in different people based on their circumstances and their values, and that those kinds of conversations can be more fruitful if we approach them with inquisitiveness and curiosity without presuming we understand how a harm has affected a person and what they define as a harm. And lastly, when we explain and have these conversations about drug-related experiences on a continuum, we can then actually talk about harm more clearly and understanding where and when and how certain people experience harms and how we can keep them safe.
That was Dr. Sheila Vicaria, Deputy Director of the Department of Research and Academic Engagement at the Drug Policy Alliance and author of The Harm Reduction Gap, Helping Individuals Left Behind by Conventional Drug Prevention and Abstinence-Only Addiction Treatment, speaking January 12th at a NASEM committee meeting on how can harm reduction policies be used to protect vulnerable populations. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for Community Radio, syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please, support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.